And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the show that aims to get you thinking. And we often bring Christians and non-Christians together on the show. Today, we're doing just that. My two guests, both going under the name Peter. One is Peter S. Williams, the other Peter Milliken. I'll introduce them properly in a moment's time. We're debating something called the ontological argument for God today. So we'll be informing you all about that in a moment's time. But Unbelievable, part of the variety of shows that we bring you every Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored. And coming up later between 4 and 5 on the profile, two fantastic guests are going to be with us. We're going to first of all hear Marcus Jones interviewing Nick Clegg, the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, ahead of the general election. He'll be sharing his thoughts on the church, on faith, and what his party is going to be doing to partner with the church in light of the general election. And then we've got Dave Rowe speaking to none other than the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. This was an interview recorded just before a lecture he gave this last week on evangelism. So he's going to be sharing his thoughts on evangelism. So Nick Clegg and the Archbishop of Canterbury on the profile this afternoon. You can also, of course, get past shows of Unbelievable if you want to search the archives, download the podcast and much more besides from the website of the programme. That's premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Lots of response to last week's programme, which was Is the Church Failing Gay Christians? Steve Chalk and Ed Shaw joined me in studio with extra guests as well, and a really fascinating discussion. Going to be having some of your feedback to that towards the end of today's programme. Also, there on the website you can find video clips. We're increasingly uploading bits and pieces from the show and videos that I've made for one reason or another. Just go to the video section of the Unbelievable website and you can find among those various parts of Unbelievable, the conference from last year, so that you can watch it online now as well. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. So we're lots to tell you about later on. Some of that feedback coming up towards the end of today's programme, and of course what's happening on next week's show. But for now, let's get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, we're doing a topic that I've long wanted to explore on Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Does God, by definition, exist? We're debating the ontological argument for God today. It's a philosophical argument that says, in essence, that if we define God as something along the lines of a maximally great being or the most perfect being, we'll talk about some of the variations, then he must, therefore, logically exist. Sounds too good to be true? Well, we'll be finding out. We're going to be hearing two people who really know their stuff on this talking about it. Peter S. Williams joins me in studio. He's a Christian philosopher. You can find out more about him and his books at peterswilliams.com. But he's going to be defending the ontological argument for God today. Our atheist guest, and I'm really pleased to have him on the line today, joining us from Oxford, is Professor Peter Milliken. He's the Gilbert Ryle Fellow and Professor of Philosophy at Hertford College, Oxford University. He's an authority on David Hume, for starters, but certainly he's turned his mind towards the ontological argument as well. And Peter was actually, for those who perhaps attended or were able to listen to or watch some of the material, one of the people that William Lane Craig debated with on the Reasonable Faith Tour back in 2011. Hardly seems that long ago, but in fact, getting on for 4 years ago, believe it or not. Anyway, a very warm welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you both. Let's start with you, Peter Milliken, because your first time on the show, though we did, of course, broadcast the debate that you had some time ago with William Lane Craig now. I remember very briefly the ontological argument being raised then. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into philosophy.
How I got into philosophy? Mm. I went up to Oxford to study maths originally, and I'd done loads and loads of maths at school and thought that was what I wanted to do. And then when I got to Oxford, I found that I was spending lots of time debating theology with people. because for the first time in my life, really, I think, I came across a lot of people who actually had pretty close to a fundamentalist belief in the Bible. I was, at the time, a very committed Christian, but I certainly wasn't a fundamentalist. Mm. And I found it, I guess that stimulated me to debate a lot. I felt that this was misconstruing what Christianity was about. I felt Christianity was terrifically important. And that got me into thinking philosophically. And I guess after a time, maths began to seem more and more sterile. And I ended up changing subject to maths and philosophy, and ultimately to philosophy and theology. So I did my first degree in that. So that's how I got into philosophy.
And in terms of your personal faith commitments, obviously in the end became convinced that actually there is no God.
That's, well, God as traditionally conceived, definitely, yes. I mean, I prefer to describe myself as a sceptic rather than an atheist.
Okay.
I certainly don't think there is any God as traditionally conceived. What strange, weird and wonderful things there may be in the universe, I don't know. But the traditional theism, it seems to me, is such a constrained theory that it is almost certainly false because it's so out of line with so much evidence. But in general, I like to think of myself as sort of open-minded and more convinced than anything, I suppose, of the limits of human knowledge. And at the same time, as at the sad tendency of humans to think they know an awful lot more than they do. I mean, I do find it absolutely absurd thinking about the theological speculations that people make about things like the incarnation and the Trinity and all that sort of stuff. To suppose that we can formulate things with any reliability about these sorts of metaphysical questions. Particularly, in the terms of antiquated philosophy, which we wouldn't now use for anything else.
Right.
Those I find a bit ridiculous.
Sure. It's really interesting to hear about your journey and where it's taken you so far. Wish we had more time to delve into that, but
yes.
We're going to be opening up a different can of worms, a slightly different can of worms anyway, with this ontological argument. And you've made no bones about the fact you really don't think this argument really has any weight to it.
I think it's philosophically interesting. I wrote a long paper in the journal Mind in 2004 about it because I obviously thought it was well worth putting time into it. But what I think is fascinating about the ontological argument is why it fails. In other words, it's an interesting logical puzzle because people have tended to disagree about why it fails. But I think Peter would agree that he's very much in a minority in thinking that it may succeed.
Okay, well, we'll find out from Peter in a moment's time. If you want to watch or listen to the debate that Peter Milliken had with William Lane Craig when we were doing the Reasonable Faith Tour a few years ago, I'll make sure there are links from today's programme as well. So check that out at premierchristianradio.com with today's programme. But it's great to have you on the line, Peter, to talk about this. And we'll introduce our other Peter now, Peter S. Williams, who is a Christian philosopher, no stranger to this show, of course. He's been on a few times over the years. But for those who maybe don't remember the last time you came along, Peter, you sort of grew up within a Christian framework, didn't you? But certainly you've been interested in pursuing the philosophical end of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, something that I discovered when I went off to university. It's interesting hearing about Peter Milliken's journey at university. I went to university originally at Cardiff University to do a joint degree in English Literature and Music.
Ah, so you're another one of these people who jumped ship.
That's right. And I ended up jumping ship to my third course at the end of my first year there. You do humanities in the University of Wales. You do three courses in the first year. So I jumped ship to my third and finished with a degree in philosophy from Cardiff and then went on studying philosophy further thereafter.
Presumably you've kind of come to a completely different conclusion in terms of Peter's one as to where that those philosophical issues led you in terms of belief in God.
Absolutely, yeah. And I would almost describe myself as something of a sort of maximalist in terms of this whole area of natural theology. It seems to me the more and the deeper I think about the arguments for God, the sort of whole philosophical area of natural theology, the more I think there is to the area and to the arguments, it seems to me.
Well, that's the idea here on the show. We always get people who completely disagree with each other to talk about issues. But I think we learn a lot in the process as well. Maybe sticking with you, first of all, Peter S. Williams, let's talk about the ontological argument. And we're going to have to, I'm afraid, in the course of today's show, boil this down as much as we can so that as many people as possible can grab onto what we're talking about today. And I'm really saying that for myself as much as anyone else. But the ontological argument sounds very fancy. In a nutshell, could you explain what it is?
Okay, well, it is an argument that starts with thinking about what we mean when we're talking about God, how you define God, or what it would mean to be God in the sort of monotheistic biblical kind of sense. And it goes back particularly to a medieval guy called St. Anselm, who came up with the first version or versions, scholars disagree, of this argument, defining God as the greatest conceivable being. Today, as you said, different phrases are used, say the maximally great being or the greatest possible being. That when we're talking about God, we're talking about a being, and this is kind of the crucial hinge point, I think, a being who's, were he to exist, the kind of existence he would have would be a necessary kind of existence rather than a sort of simply contingent or dependent sort of happenstance kind of existence.
It would be somehow logically, as you say, necessary for that being to exist.
Right. So if things exist, they either exist in dependence, in contingency upon other things, or not. And if it's greater, if it's a greater kind of being to have that sort of independence of existence, that necessity of existence, then were there to be a God, of course he would have that kind of being. Now, once you get to that stage, you can then sort of follow through arguing that, well, that would mean that the only way in which God would not exist would be if it's impossible for him to exist, because that's what it is to be a necessary being. Your existence is either actual and necessary, or you don't exist and you're impossible. The one thing that it wouldn't make sense to say is that God is could be like talking about the Loch Ness Monster, say, that, okay, maybe there is or maybe there isn't a Loch Ness Monster, but it makes sense to say, well, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. He could exist, but he doesn't, is something you could sensibly say. There could be aliens somewhere in the universe, but maybe there aren't.
Sure.
But if there's a God, he doesn't have that kind of maybe, maybe not kind of existence. So you have to kind of divide into thinking, well, okay, is God possible and therefore actual, or not actual, and therefore you have to say impossible? The one thing that it sort of doesn't make sense to say is, I suppose there could be a God, but there isn't.
Right.
It's very interesting to hear that Peter changed subject at university, just as I did. One thing I'd say to your younger listeners who may be embarking on university choice, do try to choose a course that leaves some flexibility, because so often what we end up wanting to do when we're 19 may be very different from what we thought we wanted to do when we were 17. So there's a lot to be said for joint honours courses and things that allow flexibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very, very wise advice. I know a number of people who changed ship as well at university. But coming back to the ontological argument.
Okay, so now I'll answer what you've
said. Yeah, so when it comes to the ontological argument, do you want to give us a sense of what you believe it amounts to and even some of the different versions that you think are out there?
Sure. So, as Peter said, the ontological argument standardly starts from a conception of what God is or what God would be if there were such a thing. And the idea is that the way God is understood automatically implies that he must exist, or, as Peter has suggested, it might draw the conclusion that either he's a necessary being or an impossible being, and then you make up your mind between those. The argument started with Anselm. Anselm talked about that than which nothing greater can can be thought. And that's a very clever formula, an interesting formula. I think it's subtly ambiguous, but it leads to a very interesting argument. Mm. And the basic idea is that than which nothing greater can be thought, if it didn't actually exist, then it would be possible to think of something that is greater than it. Because something that does actually exist is generally going to be greater than something that doesn't. But clearly it's a contradiction if that than which nothing greater can be thought is exceeded in greatness by something else. We get a contradiction.
Of course.
So therefore, it's impossible to deny the existence of that than which nothing greater can be thought. It's a very nice, ingenious argument. René Descartes, famous French philosopher whose Meditations came out in 1641, he produced a version of the argument which is much simpler. He just said essentially, God is the most perfect being. By definition, the concept of God includes all perfections. Existence is a perfection, therefore God must have that perfection, God must exist. And that can seem much too quick, so quick as to be pretty much incredible, I think, for most people. It's not as clever as Anselm's, not as slippery. And then more recently, Alvin Plantinga, I think in about the 60s or 70s, came out with his version of the ontological argument, which is very much along the lines that Peter sketched. You define God in such a way that either he's a necessary existent or an impossible existent, and then the argument is, well, there's nothing contradictory in the notion of God, therefore it's reasonable to suppose that God is at least possible, but if he's possible, he must be necessary, therefore there must be a God and who necessarily exists.
I want us to run through this, though. Just obviously, you guys are very familiar with this argument, but a lot of people, I think, are going to be sitting there scratching their heads, going, "Hang on, how did these philosophers who do believe in the ontological argument leap from the idea of a maximally great being to that being therefore having to exist necessarily?" So the steps are: if a property of this being, of being maximally great, is existing, you'd think that would be an important part of being maximally great. Therefore, if it's possible for there to be such a being, it must exist, because that's one of its properties.
So the
possibility of existing, because it's got this property of being maximally great, means it must therefore exist. Am I kind of getting there?
Yeah, I think you're running together two different things.
Okay.
So in the case of Descartes' argument, yes, you simply say, look, one of the great-making properties is existence, therefore the ultimately great being must have that property, must exist. Okay, so that's a relatively straightforward argument there. Where we get the stuff about necessary existence, that doesn't really feature in Descartes' argument in the same way, but it's central to Plantinga's argument. Now, there the argument is a bit different. It goes like this. Some things exist necessarily. Maybe the number one exists necessarily. You can't imagine number one ceasing to exist.
Okay.
On the other hand, lots of things exist contingently, that is, not necessarily. I mean, like the Earth, it would certainly have been possible for the Earth not to exist. It would have been possible for me not to exist. So I'm a contingent existent. Now, the thing is that if a being is contingent, then it is not even possible for it to have necessary existence. So if somebody says, let's imagine a necessarily existing human being. Well, humans are by their nature contingent existence. They can't necessarily exist. They're not the sort of thing that can have that property. So actually, a necessarily existing human being is an impossible existent. Okay, now so what we're saying is, if the property of necessary existence is not something that you can only contingently have.
Okay.
Does that make
I'm
sense?
Following that. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now if we then define a being in such a way that it does, by definition, have the property of necessary existence, then that kind of being has to be either necessary or impossible. It can't be contingent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of argument that Peter was sketching, where you say, well, God defined in this way, he's the maximally great being, mm-hmm. having necessary existence looks like the kind of property that a maximally great being ought to have. So we understand God to be a necessarily existing being, but a necessarily existing being cannot just contingently exist, so it must be either, it must genuinely necessarily exist, or else be impossible.
Yeah.
And then you give your reason for saying that
it is possible.
Impossible.
Yeah. So basically, if it's possible for God to exist, then he must exist on the ontological argument as framed by Peter and Alvin Plantinga in that
That's
sense.
That's right. But it's important to notice that the definition of God that you're considering there has to be a definition that includes necessary existence as an essential part of it.
Right.
So somebody that doesn't mean that God, as understood by anybody else, must either be impossible or necessary. But God defined in this particular way has to be.
Okay, well, let's come back to Peter S. Williams, just to get a bit of... So you've been nodding away to the way that Peter Millikan has defined it there. He's done your job for you, effectively, Peter.
That's good.
We'll obviously come to why Peter Millikan doesn't think it's a good argument. But you do set some store in it. You're willing to defend it. In fact, it was interesting. I read a chapter of a book that you wrote on the argument, and you say that other philosophers have also come to the same conclusion. You say atheist Colin McGinn recalls being impressed with the argument when he first studied it, reporting it left me with a disturbed feeling. A lot of philosophy is like that, gripping, momentous, but also worrying, naggingly so. So obviously, I'm assuming he remained an atheist.
Yes,
he wasn't in the end
did.
Convinced of it. But nonetheless, it's got this sort of, wow, to me, it's almost too easy. Can you really define God into existence by a philosophical argument?
Yeah, and it has that sort of aura, as Peter said, of being too good to be true.
Yeah.
It's like pulling a rabbit out of a hat somehow. There must be a trick to
there's some kind of
on meeting it. And I think as you asked, it's to see that the argument's not simply about just defining God into existence as a matter of sort of linguistic definition. It's not arguing along the lines of, well, by the word God, let's all agree to mean a being who exists.
Right.
God means a being who exists, so of course he exists. You know, that would be the trick. That would be the trick version.
Sure.
In terms of what Peter was saying about me being in a minority of philosophers in defending this argument, I think I'm happy to concede that.
Right.
But what I would say is that I think the majority of philosophers, it seems to me, who've looked at the sort of the Plantingan sort of necessary or contingent kind of making that distinction kind of version of the argument, agree that it's a logically valid argument.
Okay.
But that the disagreement comes with the crucial premise as to whether or not God is actually possible.
Right.
So once you've said God is either possible and therefore necessary and therefore real, or he's impossible, you've given an escape clause of saying, well, all right, then I'll just say he's impossible.
Right. Okay.
So
most people say attack that premise.
That's
then,
right.
So they
agree on the logical structure of the argument. That all seems to be fine.
Right.
Most people are happy to say, but then the debate really gets heated up over the crucial premise, well, is God possible or is he impossible? Because you can say either.
do you, first of all, Peter Millikan, agree with that it is a logical argument that it follows if the premises are true, let's say?
Well, yeah, my inclination is to agree with Peter here. I mean, some will say no. It depends on particular assumptions about what's called modal logic, that is, the logic of necessity and possibility. And indeed, it does depend on certain assumptions there, but they're not implausible assumptions.
Okay.
And my general line with these sorts of arguments is not to focus on, if you like, footling quibbles like that. I want to say, no, you can have your logical framework. Let's then see if the argument works given that framework. And if it did, that would be quite impressive.
But you don't think it does?
No, well, the problem with it is that it goes far too quickly. You end up with a definition of God which has the following implication. If God, so defined, po- possibly exists, then he necessarily exists. But it's also a consequence of that definition that if God, so defined, possibly doesn't exist, then God necessarily doesn't exist. So the way the definition is drawn, the atheist and the theist are, as it were, you know, in the same place as far as that goes. So it's not as though the theist can say, well, look, I'm just making a minimal claim that God is possible. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to claim that he's impossible, which is a much stronger claim to make.
Okay.
No, actually, all the atheist needs to say, God possibly doesn't exist. Because the trouble is, given the way God's defined, he can't be just contingent. So he's either necessary or impossible. So, you know, if he possibly exists, then he necessarily does. If he possibly doesn't, then he necessarily doesn't. And it might look as though it's a coin toss. But at that point, what I would say is, look, here's a corresponding argument. Let an N rabbit be a necessarily existing rabbit, a rabbit that has the property of necessary existence. Okay? And then I can run the same sort of argument and say, well, if it's possible that there's an N rabbit, then it's necessary that there's an N rabbit. And, you know, an N rabbit doesn't seem to be a contradiction in terms, so there we are, there's a necessary...
Exactly. I think that's, again, the logic, see, the logic is parallel, but it's going to come down to the soundness of the premise, the truth of the premise. So I'd take us back to the comment Peter made earlier about a necessarily existing human being being an impossibility, because human beings by nature are contingent things. I'd say exactly the same point about a rabbit by nature is a contingent thing.
Absolutely.
But of course you can't run that argument against God, because God by definition is not a contingent thing.
Well, hang on, can I come back on
that? Of course, do
so. So yeah, of course I'm putting the example of a rabbit because I want to refute it. I want to give, you know, some, nobody's going to say that a rabbit is a,
sure,
is a, but the point I'm making is that the argument as presented gives nothing at all to suppose that God is different, okay? Because the premise is that God thus defined is a necessary existent. I'm allowing that. You can define that as you like. You can define a necessarily existing rabbit like that.
Yeah.
So the fact that you can define it doesn't do anything at all to establish its reality.
That's right. I completely agree. I completely agree. I think that's when you, as I say, you get into the debate then is all about
the possibility.
Are there any actual, you know, is there more reason or not, arguments for or against the crucial premise? Because this, I think it's a point made by the philosopher Peter Van Inwagen, who pointed out on the ontological argument that you can't, the defender can't simply say, well, we ought to give the benefit of the doubt to possibility claims. Because actually, if that's all that I was saying, well, you know, I've got the claim it's possible that God exists, and you ought to give that the benefit of the doubt because, you know, sure, you know, anything's possible. Kind of. Well, actually, you could say the same about the reverse concept. You could say, maybe it's possible that there's someone who knows that God's existence is impossible.
Right.
And if you ought to give every possibility claim the benefit of the doubt,
everything would be proved.
It would self-cancel out. So it's going to come down to, do we have some reasons for thinking that it's more plausibly true than false to say that God is possible, or the reverse?
We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back to this. I hope you've got your thinking caps on this afternoon. We're talking about the ontological argument for God here on Unbelievable. My guests are Peter S. Williams, Christian philosopher, and Peter Millikan, who's a professor and a professor of philosophy in Oxford. We're talking about this argument that says, is it possible that by definition God exists? And we'll be back in a moment's time to continue discussing it.
Premier Christianity, for cutting edge commentary and encouraging stories,
tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Christian rapper Governor B charts the rise of holy hip hop in the latest magazine as we meet the rising stars bringing the gospel to a new generation. And we've invented a new word for people who bring kingdom into their commerce. Meet the Godpreneurs. Plus, Steve Chalk and Sean Doherty share their different responses to the question, is the church failing gay Christians? Plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
But we're continuing our discussion this Saturday afternoon on the ontological argument for God here on Unbelievable. We call ourselves the show that helps to get you thinking, and we've certainly asked you to don your thinking cap today. Very philosophical discussion. And the ontological argument for God essentially is an argument that says if we simply define God in essence as a maximally great being, that might be one way of putting it, then by definition that must include existence, and therefore if it's possible for such a God to exist, he does exist. That's a very thumbnail sketch of it, and we've been hearing some of the more technical aspects of what that might mean from my guests today on the programme. Peter S. Williams joins me. He's a Christian philosopher. Find out more about him at petersswilliams.com. And Professor Peter Millikan, who's a Gilbert Ryle Fellow and Professor of Philosophy at Hertford College, Oxford University. And he's been explaining why, as far as he's concerned, there really isn't. It's an interesting argument, but it's very hard to ultimately defend the ontological argument. So just in that last section, Peter Millikan, Peter Williams was explaining that, yes, he certainly is in the minority when it comes to people who defend the ontological argument. As far as he's concerned, you've got a defensible version of it. It really does come down to the question of whether it's possible or not possible for such a God as defined to exist. Is that kind of the point at which you kind of, as it were, level your attack at the argument as to whether it is indeed possible for such a God to exist?
Okay, well, I think I've been trying so far to avoid any detailed discussion about different notions of necessity and possibility. Mm. And they might become pertinent.
Okay, here. So we're going to have to steel ourselves for yet another leap in technicality. Yeah. But yeah, let's go for it.
We might, yeah. But for the moment, let me say the following. It seems to me that the onus of proof is very, very much on the theist. Here's why. I gave the example earlier of a necessarily existing rabbit, an N-rabbit. And we all agree that there can be no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
A rabbit is not the sort of thing that can necessarily exist or that can have the property of necessary existence in the relevant sense. Now, given that that's the case, we have a decisive reason for rejecting the ontological argument for the existence of a necessarily existing rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, given you've got a toss-up, either, in a sense, either it's possible that there's such a necessarily existing rabbit, or it's possible that there isn't, and we know that whichever possibility you go for, that's going to imply a necessity. But given that choice, we will much prefer to say, no, that sort of thing cannot necessarily exist.
Mm-hmm.
A rabbit is not the sort of thing that can have the property of necessary existence. Okay, so what sort of things can have the property of necessary existence in the relevant sense?
Mm.
Well, one's inclined to say things like numbers.
Yeah.
The number one, the number four, these are things that could not fail to exist. If they do exist, they absolutely necessarily exist.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as I'm referring to a genuine possible number, there must be such a thing. And what sort of things do we think couldn't have that property? Well, generally, the things that we encounter in the contingent world, the things that have causal influence on us, the things that we see around us. Now, God, as traditionally understood, is a being who acts in the world, who has causal powers, who does things. That doesn't look like the sort of abstract object to which we are prepared to ascribe necessary existence. So I would say that given that the notion of God is much more like the notion of a person than it is like the notion of a number,
mm-hmm.
we have very strong reason for saying that God belongs with persons
mm-hmm.
as a contingent rather than a necessary existence in the sense that we're using it here. That is the sense of logically necessary existence, the sort of necessity that has the properties that Alvin Plantinga ascribes.
Yes.
Now, somebody might say, but look, everybody understands that God's existence, if God exists, is going to be different from that of humans. God is not going to be dependent on other things in the way that we are.
Mm.
God is not going to need to be created, nor will he pass out of existence as we will. Now, I can concede that. I can say, yes, absolutely. But the kind of necessity you're talking about there is not the necessity of logical possibility and impossibility. Mm. There, you're talking about something very different, which is a kind of independence. And that is not the sort of necessity to which Plantinga's argument can properly be taken to apply, or at least it requires significant argument to say that it would.
Okay, very interesting. I mean, I've sometimes heard it said as well as an objection, well, if you know, you could define a pizza as having,
exactly,
great making properties of being, and that would mean that, you know, necessarily the greatest ever pizza has to exist, yeah, and so on. And I hear the same point being made here, that we don't do that for contingent objects like pizzas, like rabbits. What reason do we have to do it for what, in your view, Peter Millikan, is another contingent object, as far as you can see, God? So the weight of the burden of proof is on Peter Williams to explain why God is a necessary thing in the way that a number is, almost. So Peter, do you agree? Is that what you have to now show, that God is necessary in this particular way?
I don't think so. I think what's being left out here is a third kind of category of being, as it were. Peter has drawn a distinction between contingent, concrete, physical beings like rabbits and human bodies and pizzas and so on, and abstract objects like
numbers,
as Plato conceived them. But of course, abstract objects, as you said, are traditionally defined as causally impotent. They don't interact. Mm-hmm. The number one, if it exists, hasn't ever caused anything, and so on. But there is a third category, and of course, God, as traditionally conceived, is neither thought of as being a contingent, concrete, physical being, nor as being an abstract object.
Inert object,
yeah,
sure.
But as being a concrete, non-physical, i.e. spiritual being, who has independent and necessary existence, who was not created, didn't come into being, will never go out of being, and so on. And so I think he's just posed a false dilemma, leaving out this third category.
What do you say to that, Peter Millikan?
Yeah, well, I want to respond that you can't have it both ways. If you're going to use the logical framework of Plantinga's argument, which relies on a particular interpretation of modality, you want, for example, to say that what is necessary or impossible doesn't vary from possible world to possible world, that's an essential part of Plantinga's argument, then that only works if you're using a very austere notion of necessity, namely something like broad logical necessity. But once you start talking about dependency and things like that, you know, whether one being depends on other beings, I've conceded, because I'm quite happy to acknowledge that the notion of God as traditionally understood involves, if you like, some rather more meaty notions of necessity, but those won't give you the ontological argument. So you can say, look, I believe that there is a God who is necessary in the sense of being completely self-sufficient, independent, never passing out of existence, never needing to come into existence, etc., etc. And you can say, you know, I think there is such a being. My response will be, well, maybe there is, but if there is, you cannot prove it using Plantinga's type of argument. You're going to have to give some positive reason for supposing that there is such a thing. And simply talking about such a being, it goes no way to showing that there really is one. Even if I allow you to have the concept, personally, I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to say, let's allow that concept makes sense. Where's the argument that there actually is such a being?
Right. Well, I think perhaps, and it's difficult without getting into, do we want to get into the difference between logical and metaphysical and necessities and so on? But I think,
well, let's give it a go.
Going back to the,
you've taken us this far. We might as well go the whole hog.
The sketch that I started with, where I'm basically sort of boiling down Plantinga's kind of argument into a single syllogism and saying with the notion of God as the maximally great or greatest possible kind of being, as saying that if one exists, one either does have contingent or necessary existence, the other option being impossibility, that God is either impossible or possible in the kind of existence that he has, and that as we're seeing, the debate is about, well, is it possible for God and therefore necessary and real, that follows that's not hinging upon treating God as an abstract object, but on thinking of God as a metaphysically real object, but not a concrete physical object, but a metaphysical reality who, were he to exist, would exist with a necessity of existence, that it wouldn't be possible for him to not exist. Okay. That there's in the Plantinga, there's no possible world in which such a being would not exist. But I don't think that's depending upon treating God as one of these sort of abstract objects.
You don't think, therefore, that the type of necessity in this argument that you're essentially borrowing from Alvin Plantinga, that necessity is restricted to this very austere notion that Peter Millikan says it is to things like an abstract object, numbers.
Yeah,
and so on.
It's the kind of necessity that one would talk about in talking about the, say, the contingency cosmological argument, where you're talking about metaphysical necessity or contingency.
So just run us through that. So in that case, the necessity of the cosmological argument is that there must be something because.
Because there are things that exist. If one exists, one exists either contingently or necessarily. You can't have an infinite regress of contingent things depending upon contingent things, concrete
objects.
So there must be a necessary thing somewhere, something whose existence is necessary, not contingent.
Right.
And if it's necessary, well, then it's necessary. Yeah.
So okay, go ahead. Yes, Peter Millikan.
Yeah. So the way I'd respond to that, the kind of notion of necessity that one might want for the cosmological argument is a sort of ontological self-sufficiency, that, you know, I clearly am a contingent being. I various causes produced me. I didn't produce myself. I couldn't have existed by myself, and so forth. And one's tempted to say, well, you know, we look around us and we see all these contingent existence in that sense, and we. There is a natural tendency to want to trace it back to some self-sufficient, necessary existent, and that's where we get the God of the cosmological argument. So I agree with Peter there, but I mean, I don't think it's a good argument, but I think it's a tempting argument. Mm. But notice that notion of necessity is not logical necessity, or even broad logical necessity, as Plantinga calls it. So imagine a possible world in which there was such a being. In that world, such a being could never go out of existence, all right? So such a being would be, as it were, necessary in that world. But you can also imagine a world in which there was no such being. And if you accept the cosmological argument, you might think that therefore there will be nothing in that world, but, you know, that's debatable. Mm. But whether there are other things in that world or not needn't concern us. The point is that you could imagine a world containing such a self-sufficient being, and you can also imagine a world that doesn't contain such a self-sufficient being. And the point would be that in those different worlds, they now have different possibilities and necessities by virtue of either containing or not containing such a being. Now, straight away, that means the logical principles of Plantinga's argument won't work, because Plantinga's argument depends on the necessities and possibilities not varying from world to world. So my claim is that if you mean that kind of self-sufficiency, you have to get rid of Plantinga's argument. You might be able to go for the cosmological argument, but the ontological argument isn't going to help you.
So I think my comeback is going to be that's exactly the point that I disagree with you upon, that where you say, we can imagine a world in which there's no necessary being and there are other things. That's perhaps what I want to say. Well, you can imagine it, but is that logically possible? That actually, that the very point at issue is whether that is actually metaphysically possible or not. So that the very point that you set aside, I think, is the crucial point at variance.
Okay, so could I here appeal to Christian tradition? Because those who defend the cosmological argument very commonly raise the question, why is there something rather than nothing? They say, oh, Leibniz's. There could so easily have been nothing. It requires explanation that there is a world here, and they think God provides that explanation. They themselves are saying there could so easily have been nothing. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. If the existence of anything is so sort of a priori surprising that it requires the cosmological argument, then you can't say at the same time that there's some sort of inherent contradiction in there being nothing. And if there could have been nothing, then the necessities and possibilities in that world would be different from any world that contains a necessary being, a necessary God, in which case Plantinga's argument can't work. So I'm going to kind of play the arguments against each other.
Well, I tell you, I'm just about keeping up here. But so look, as I understand it, right, if Peter Millikan is saying to you, Peter Williams, if you want to defend the ontological argument, as you put it, you need a God who necessarily exists. But if I can imagine a world where nothing exists, including, obviously, the God, then evidently I've managed to undercut your argument there. You've said, but that's the whole point, isn't it? Could there be such a world in which a God does not exist?
Yeah, it's whether one can coherently imagine such a world.
Right.
In other words, it's back to the question, is God's existence as defined possible, let's say broadly, logically, metaphysically possible, or metaphysically impossible?
And then Peter Millikan's come back and said, if you're using that, then I'm going to take away the cosmological argument, the idea that it could, you know, it could have been that there was nothing, but we are, you know, but the fact there is something needs explaining. So I'm not going to let you have both of those arguments, Peter, in your arsenal. You'll have to choose one of them.
Well, I think there are ways.
The crucial point here is that there are two notions of necessity and possibility in play.
Right.
And I'm basically saying to the theist, well, you know, take your pick, but you can't, as it were, get the benefits of both and combine them together.
Okay.
You're not going to be able to have the cosmological argument, the sort of necessity that applies to the cosmological argument, and then play that through Plantinga's ontological argument.
Right. Well, thus far, even if that argument works, all that means is I have to pick between these two arguments for theism. It's not actually an argument against the ontological argument. But I think there are ways of interpreting that Leibnizian question of why does anything exist?
Right.
Is actually the answer actually that it seemed to come out with at the end is because it's impossible for nothing to exist.
Right.
Because there does exist something that has necessary existence.
i.e. God.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's not a case of having to choose between the two arguments. I mean, this is taking us into a whole different argument.
It's a whole other, that's a whole other show, folks.
any response there, Peter Millikan?
But here the point is the notion of necessity. Point I was making is that the kind of self-sufficient necessity that is commonly thought to be required by the cosmological argument is an argument which, when you look at the necessities concerned, they could vary from world to world in the logical sense. So that cannot be the necessity that you need for Plantinga's argument. And again, I'm happy to accept that the notion of a self-sufficient being makes sense. You know, you can define that however you like. I'll give you that it makes sense. But the theist has to show that there is one. And if he can't do it by the logic of the ontological argument, then how's he going to do it? Now, the cosmological argument attempts to show that there must be such a thing. And, of course, if that worked, then that would supply the missing link, as it were. But I'm not persuaded by that. And I don't think the ontological argument is any help here because that requires a different notion of necessity. Incidentally, I think it's a shame we haven't discussed Anselm at all because perhaps if I can just very quickly say with the Plantinga argument, if somebody wants a very quick put down of it, I would say this. Plantinga's argument is such like, it essentially says this. The following kind of being, namely, a perfect being which is such that if it possibly exists, then it necessarily exists, possibly exists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that is just begging the question. It's saying, I'm going to define a being in such a way that if it possibly exists, then it necessarily exists, and then I'm going to say that it possibly exists.
Right.
I really think it's got no more force than that.
And in that sense, it's semantics and wordplay, as far as you're concerned, to that degree, Peter.
He's defining a notion in such a way that its mere possibility will imply its necessity, and then saying that it possibly exists. And I think that really shouldn't persuade us.
Well, that's kind of exactly what you said we shouldn't be doing with this argument at the beginning, Peter Williams.
But yeah, absolutely. I kind of agree with that point. But as I said, that is only as much as to say to agree that with Plantinga's logic is fine, but it all comes down to saying you've got to say more than give me the benefit of the doubt when I say that it's the crucial premise, it's possible.
Yeah.
That you've got to say something more than that.
Yeah, but I'm adding that the logic is only sound if you presuppose a particular notion of necessity, and that particular notion I don't think is going to give you what you want, you know, from the kind of cosmological view of God.
I mean, okay, we're just coming towards the end of this second part, so let's start to wrap things up. Peter S. Williams, I'm not sure where to go from this. We kind of have reached an impasse, I think.
We could have discussed Anselm.
Let's maybe talk about Anselm at some point as well. But how much kind of, you know, because it's a somewhat complex argument anyway to get your head around, is this one that, you know, if someone said, give me your best proof for God, you'd give to them? or would you say, would you reserve this when you're 2 hours into the conversation?
That's right, it wouldn't be the one I draw out of my top pocket first, let's put it like that. And I certainly wouldn't produce it as it sometimes has been produced in the history of philosophy, as kind of, here's a knockdown argument.
Okay.
For God, that it just shows, you know, it's you know, you're stupid if you think there's no God once I've defined it like this, etc., etc. What I think it does is you've got a logically valid argument that if you can show you've got more reason than not for thinking that it is possible for a maximally great maximally great being to exist, it's difficult to say, then it's an argument that gives you some reason to believe in God. It's part of the cumulative case of arguments for God that I would give.
Do you know of anyone who has changed their view on the basis of this argument alone? I mean, could you tell me anything?
Yeah, I do. There's a philosopher called Trent Doherty, for example, who has said that he changed his mind because
he
of the
became a theist
argument.
Because of the ontological. Yeah. Do you know anyone, Peter? Peter Millikan, in this case?
I'm not sure. Bertrand Russell is reputed to have said at one point, my great God in boots, the ontological argument is sound after all.
It was a passing phase.
But I don't think this lasted for long.
Right, okay.
But on the other hand, I wonder, this is a personal speculation, if Bertrand Russell's interest in what became his theory of descriptions might have been motivated by trying to show that the logic of the ontological argument doesn't work.
Right.
In other words, I think it may have had quite a significant influence on the development of 20th century philosophical thought, actually.
Yeah. So I've heard what you've both said, and I think it's a really interesting one. I mean, it's one that I honestly don't quite know where I stand on. I would never really attempt to persuade someone using the ontological argument, because I only just about grasp it myself, I think. I suppose it plays into lots of other arguments. As we said, it kind of links at some level to the cosmological argument and other things. Do you think that the other way in which it gets attacked, Peter Millikan, by people saying, well, I'm going to show to you why God is not possible, is a kind of an incoherent concept in the first place. Is that another way in which you would be happy to kind of, you know, have a go at this argument, if you like, apart from talking about the nature of necessity?
I mean the understanding of God that I have had myself and is not one which makes, according to which God is either logically necessary or logically impossible. So personally I'm not particularly attracted by that line, but I'm happy to give it as a kind of reductio ad absurdum. That is, the person who thinks that the ontological argument is a good argument is putting themselves in danger of defining God in such a way that he could actually be logically impossible. I mean, just like I don't believe that it's possible to have a necessarily existing rabbit, I don't believe that it's possible to have a logically necessarily existing God. I'm distinguishing that from the sort of self-sufficient kind of necessity, which may well be possible for all I know, but that's a different concept.
We're going to take another quick break, and we'll just have 5 or 10 minutes to start wrapping things up. And I know you wanted to briefly mention Anselm's version of this as well to Peter Millikan. So we'll go to another break and come back in a short moment's time, and we'll finish this discussion on the ontological argument for God. Asking today on Unbelievable: does God, by definition, exist?
Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Part of Faith Explored and brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. If you want to get hold of a copy, you can find a free sample copy simply by going to our website and asking for one. premierchristianity.com/free sample. The March edition is out now, and some fantastic features in it. I can highly recommend getting your hands on the hard copy, if you like, of it, as well as looking at the articles that we've put online this month. But something you might be interested in if you are an Unbelievable listener is the article by Steve Chalk and Sean Doherty on that question from last week's show: is the church failing gay Christians? But also in the Faith Explored pages there in the magazine, I asked Peter J. Williams, who's the warden at Tyndale House and an Old Testament scholar, to look at the question: did God command genocide in the Old Testament? Which again is a subject we tackled recently on the programme, and he gives his answer. It's a really interesting one if you're able to pick up a copy of the magazine. premierchristianity.com/free sample to order a free sample copy of March's edition. Just a quick mention as well that something exciting coming up this week is John Lennox. He's going to be launching his book Against the Flow: The Inspiration of Daniel in an Age of Relativism. He is, of course, a professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford. He's widely associated with other organisations as well, including the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, who are doing the book launch there in Oxford. It looks like an excellent book. Does history have meaning? Are there ultimate values? Where does individual significance come from? So in an election year here in the UK, the biblical book of Daniel seems more relevant than ever. And so if you want to go along to that, it's happening at the Jacqueline Dupré Music Building, St Hilda's College in Oxford. That's Thursday, the 12th of March at 6 p.m. So if you can get down to Oxford, or you're living in and around the area, Thursday, the 12th of March at 6 p.m, go and see Professor John Lennox launching his book Against the Flow at St Hilda's College that evening. More details available, I think, from The Ochre, theochre.org, for more details. We've got some of your feedback to come soon in the programme. Going to be looking back at last week's programme, where we asked, is the church failing gay Christians? And we had masses of response to that. So I'll just be trying to wade through some of that. We're going to be hearing your response to one or two other programmes that we had recently as well. Time now, though, for the final part of this discussion. I've been joined today by Peter S. Williams and Peter Millikan, one a Christian philosopher, the other a sceptical atheist philosopher, talking about the ontological argument for God.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, coming back to both of you gentlemen, you wanted to talk about Anselm, the way that he defined the ontological argument as well, Peter Millikan. Was he one of the first to dream up this particular argument?
Oh, he was the first.
He was the first, yes.
Absolutely, yes. It's his great argument. And the reason I think Anselm's version is particularly interesting is that it's much cleverer than the others, I think.
Mm.
And what particularly makes it slippery is that it hides certain ambiguities, and these ambiguities are really quite difficult to see. So let me just give you an example of this. Suppose I say God is that than which nothing greater can be thought. Okay, that than which nothing greater can be thought. And now I ask you, can you think of anything greater than, and here I choose some immensely powerful, good, individual, So I'm going to choose Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor, who probably had the greatest combination of wisdom and power that maybe there has ever been in the world. Despots are not normally very good people. Can you think of anything greater in terms of power, wisdom, goodness than Marcus Aurelius? And you probably can't, okay? Because anybody you think of who was better than Marcus Aurelius morally almost certainly didn't have anything like as much power.
Okay.
So I'm going to say, well, Marcus Aurelius is that than which nothing greater can be thought, because you cannot think of anything greater than Marcus Aurelius. Okay. Now, you're going to say, well, wait a minute, that's obviously not what I meant when I said that than which nothing greater can be thought. I wasn't thinking of anything less than God, right? So then I say, well, okay, what do you mean by that than which nothing greater can be thought? You don't just mean that which is so great that it's not possible to think of anything greater. No, you say, it's that than which it wouldn't be possible for there to be anything greater. Well, okay, but how do I know that there is such a thing? And the risk is that when you say that than which, it sounds like you're actually speaking of a thing that exists. But so there's another ambiguity between that thing which is in fact so great that nothing could possibly be greater, or that which, if it existed, than which nothing could possibly be greater. So basically you get a three-way ambiguity in Anselm's formula. And what's so ingenious and interesting, philosophically interesting about it, is the way in which the different interpretations of it fail for different reasons. So there's no one reason why Anselm's argument fails. Whichever objection you put to it, there is a way round it, unless you take account of the fact that the formula is fundamentally ambiguous. So, I think as a, if you like, as a logical exhibit, it's really fascinating.
Yes. Now, you haven't attempted in that sense, Peter Williams, to defend Anselm's version.
No.
And do you agree that it...
I'd attack it on other grounds as well. I think Anselm's version particularly equivocates between him talking about the God existing in your mind and in reality, being greater than God just existing in your mind alone, and therefore it being self-contradictory to say you've got the idea of God in your mind, but that you say there's no God. And of course that equivocates between God existing in your mind or the idea of God existing in your mind, and so they're not the same thing.
It's a bit of a bait and switch,
which is why I think that the more modern sort of Plantinga-esque version, which the majority of
is taken a lot more seriously.
Yeah, it's taken a lot more seriously, and as much as the majority of philosophers at least think it's logically valid, and all the discussion is on, well, is it metaphysically possible for God to exist or not?
Yeah. It is a fascinating area, and I'm still trying to get my head around some of the issues that have been raised in the course of today's program. I hope if you're listening, it's helped you to think through this. Maybe you've heard of the ontological argument. Just something I should have asked right at the beginning of the program, but just for those who just don't know, why is it called the ontological argument? What does that refer to? What does the word ontological mean? Perhaps Peter Millikan, do you want to explain that?
Yes. I remember writing a paper on various arguments about the existence of God and agonizing over whether to use upper or lowercase letters. And I decided the ontological argument, you have to use uppercase letters because the ontological argument is a name, not a description.
Okay.
Okay, the word ontological just means to do with existence.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And just like the cosmological argument, you know, that has to be a name of an argument because lots of arguments are cosmological, lots of arguments are ontological. But Immanuel Kant, I think it was, gave the name ontological argument to this particular argument, and it stuck. So when people talk about the ontological argument, capital O, capital A, that is, I think, a proper name of this argument.
Right. And it's because it's to do with existence. That's what ontology...
Yeah, but lots of philosophers' arguments are to do with existence. So you see what I mean?
Yes, indeed.
There are lots of arguments that are ontological, but only one capital O ontological
means
argument.
We're talking about the argument for God specifically. Yes. Sure.
And, well, when I say there's only one, actually, of course, we've been talking about variants of it.
Yes.
I take it there's an ontological argument, capital O, is an argument for God's existence which starts from something like a bare definition or a bare concept or a bare understanding of God, what God is or would be. and doesn't rely on any input from, as it were, the nature of the world.
Sure.
And by the way, you asked the question to Peter, but not to me.
Mm.
But if I were a theist, I would not be pushing the ontological argument. I'd be pushing the fine-tuning argument.
Yes, you feel there's a lot more leverage there in terms of potential fruit.
Yeah, but, I think that's a genuinely interesting argument and raises some fascinating questions, whereas I think most of the traditional arguments for God are literally useless. Right. They deliver almost nothing.
Speaking of the fine-tuning argument, that, of course, was the main aspect of what you debated William Lane Craig on a few years ago. And I will post links to that as well. If people want to hear more from Peter Millikan, then do go to the website today, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Peter S. Williams, before we finish up, if people want to do further reading, any particular resources you could recommend?
Yeah, sure. Well, to blow my own trumpet for a moment, there's a chapter on the ontological argument, capital O, capital A, in my recent book, A Faithful Guide to Philosophy, published with Paternoster Press, and we'll give a link on the website, I'm sure. And I've got a YouTube playlist of little videos about the ontological argument that we could link to as well.
And I'll make sure to link to your books and website as well, Peter Millikan, so that people can find out more.
Can I suggest one thing?
Of course.
There's an online resource which is excellent called the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Mm. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. It's very suitable for university students and so on.
Mm.
School children might find it quite demanding.
Okay.
But it is an excellent resource on all things philosophical, and its discussions of various arguments for God are well worth looking at.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the programme, both of you gentlemen. And I'm pleased to be able to say we've done the ontological argument now on Unbelievable. We probably won't come back to it for another 8 years, but we can say we've done it. So great. Thank you, Peter Millikan and Peter S. Williams, for being with me
Thanks
today.
Thanks so much. Great
thank
being
you.
With
nice
you,
Peter. To talk to you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you do want to get in touch and leave your thoughts about today's programme, why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also send me your thoughts via Facebook or Twitter. If you want to follow on Twitter, it's @unbelievablejb. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow me on the Facebook page of the show. And we're going to be looking at some of your responses now to last week's show, specifically under the show that went up online. So the online version of the show that you can find at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Steve Chalk and Ed Shaw joined me with their different perspectives on the question of whether the church is failing gay Christians. And on the line, we were joined by Jane Ozan, who was a leading evangelical in the Church of England. But after she came out, changed her perspective on the issue of sexuality. She was talking about her journey. And we also heard from Rosaria Butterfield, who kind of went in the opposite direction, having been a lesbian English professor who, when she found faith, that changed a lot in her life, including her eventually actually marrying a Reformed church pastor. So it was a really interesting show. Lots of different perspectives that were included on that show. And if you go to the show and look at some of the discussion underneath it on the web page, you'll find some of this. And I'm just going to read a few of the contributions that are there. Russell, who said, "This show confirmed to me that the homosexual activists inside and outside of the church will never stop until the theology of the church is changed to affirm homosexuality and gay marriage. How many times did we hear Steve Chalk and Jane insist that the theology of the church must change? Steve can say, kudos for having this conversation about the church and why it's failed. We must continue to dialogue. But when an orthodox Christian position is pressed upon him, he starts to whine and huff and demand that the theology of the church must change. Rosaria Butterfield was absolutely right." And then Jane pipes up and says, "Well, that's her journey, now I have mine. While I respect her position, I've chosen my way, and I'm seeking God in my way, and he has affirmed my way." Jane throws out her ability to read Hebrew and Greek as if God has given her the decoder ring that no one in the last 4,000 years had. And then we're told about the great number of evangelical leaders who want to come out of the closet but can't because they're afraid of losing funding. These wolves in sheep's clothing should be removed so that they can dialogue with Steve Chalk more often. I propose they all form a gay denomination and consult with Mel White on how to do it." Anyway, there you go. That was Russell's thoughts. D&BJ13
came back on that to say, Russell, your post fails to acknowledge that the doctrine of homosexuality has already changed, even within the confines of the Bible. Scriptures you didn't quote are those that required God's people to put homosexuals to death, along with witches and the like. While that's not exactly retracted, we get the sense that Christians were not to put homosexuals and adulterers to death. That is a major doctrinal change. If the doctrine can change that much within Scripture, why suppose it's out of line for it to continue to evolve? T. Danny says it's a battle for your faith. With due respect to the opinions of all who have commented, I think God's grace, love, forgiveness, etc. has been misinterpreted by the church. I think grace should empower us to overcome sin and not to habitually live it because of God's love and grace covers it all. Jesus loves sinners but not their sins, and he expects us to accept his saving grace and then go and sin no more after receiving forgiveness. The church is continuously under pressure to accept whatever is socially or politically correct. Whereas Haggai 1:9 responds to that to say, quoting you, the church is continuously under pressure to accept. You say that real church isn't under any pressure that it should lead to acceptance. It may hear the clamour of trial and tribulation, but it doesn't participate in it. Although it is called to object to the unrighteousness behind such clamour, it does so as a body corporate with authority and power which the world doesn't have. The early church learned all of this in times very similar to today. We need to be as stoic as they were. I'll just read one more comment from the comment section underneath the show online. Ray, who says, I was really intrigued by Jane O'Zan's comments that it or her love of women's same-sex attraction is not about sex. This isn't a cheap shot, but I'm not sure I understand what she means, because to my mind, it's profoundly about sex. For I'm sure that throughout history, there have been numerous examples of deep and inseparable bonds of love and friendship and companionship between man and men and women, father, mother, son, daughter, brothers, sisters, man, woman, and young children, even mankind and animals, all without involving sex. To my mind, if Jane, as she says, loves women but controls her sexual urges towards them, then I really don't see a problem with that. Nor do I see any problem with any of the aforementioned relationships if they don't involve sex. So it seems to me it really does boil down to sex. I'm just trying to understand what she means, but I'm not really seeing it. And you go on to say, I do think that Ed's point about taking up the cross is important. I may have a deep admiration, profound love and great longing for my neighbour's wife and be absolutely convinced that she completes me. It may even drive me to distraction, depression and ill health, but surely I know that I cannot have her. That's the cost of discipleship. But then there are far greater and deeper costs than the one that Jane or I may feel we're asked to hear. Anyway, those were just some of the comments that came in on the back of that. But also, you've been sending in your emails. Here's Michael, who says, as an atheist, there is a workaround. If evangelicals had to live a life of celibacy after their first divorce, perhaps they'd show more compassion for homosexuals. But evangelicals have managed to overlook Jesus' strong instructions regarding divorce and remarriage, picking and choosing scriptures that cast their solution in a Bible-approved light. Straight evangelicals could interpret the Bible in a manner supportive of their LGBT brethren, if they really wanted to, but instead they insist their lesbian sisters and gay brothers in Christ do without any physical intimacy for a lifetime, merely because God crafted them differently. So there must be some other reason evangelicals refuse to apply a similar sort of selective interpretation to a couple of lines in Leviticus. Is this reason any better than those once used to justify the subjugation of women, beating of children, laws against interracial marriage, or the practice of chattel slavery? Perhaps in time we will see an end to homophobia, and it can join these other injustices in the dustbin of history. Grace weighs in and says, I hope you're having an awesome week, Justin. Thanks again for a fantastic magazine and broadcast. I've been finding the past programs really interesting, trying to promote the program wherever I can. Thank you, Grace. You say, in response to the article and program on homosexuality, though I must say first that I'm terrified of coming across as judgmental. I certainly don't feel judgmental, but can be bad at wording myself accurately. But I'm just going to quote a couple of things you say here, Grace. You say, I agree that, as he said on the show, Ed and those like him with same-sex attraction but who live in celibacy are heroes of the faith. He is putting God's wisdom first. As Christians, we don't believe that God's priority is that we be happy, as Steve Chalk advocated, but that we be holy. The eternity that we will spend with him will make our struggles in this life seem, as Paul says, momentary. If we don't find our relationship with God exciting enough to sacrifice sex for, we haven't pursued it deeply enough. And if we're unwilling to sacrifice sexuality for the sake of putting God first in our lives, we will drift away from him. St. Paul's teaching to the Corinthians makes me very concerned that those who take Chalk's approach are causing a lot of harm, supporting something that will separate people ultimately from full intimacy with God. Thank you very much, Grace. Interesting perspective from you on that. And here's some more that came in by email. Margaret says, "Hi, I'd like to support Ed Shaw in the position he takes on same-sex issues, a stance which I think is not very popular. Well done, Ed. Now, I'm 56, heterosexual, but so far celibate, as I've not met a man I'd like to marry. So thank you for bringing up the point that we can be fulfilled without sexual intercourse. I agree that the church is in danger of taking on board the world's view, which is contrary to this. Thank you for your very well-styled programme," says Margaret. It's interesting because you've raised the issue that Ed was making in the point in the programme there, that, you know, singleness, whether you be an unmarried person, someone who is divorced or whatever it might be in the church, is equally an issue in terms of sexuality as it is for those with same-sex attraction. Though, of course, inevitably there is a difference, I think, because there is no ultimate chance, if you take a conservative position, of having a sexual relationship in the end. Though obviously there would be for you, Margaret, if you did meet the right man. Didymus Thomas says, "Gay Christian, quote unquote, is an oxymoron. Since scripture does not contradict itself, the term gay Christian isn't found in the Bible. I find the word sodomite used, and homosexual too. I also find that unrepentant sodomites will not inherit the kingdom of God, no matter how much they're in love. You've got it wrong. The church hasn't failed homosexuals, but homosexuals have failed the Lord. Sodomy is an abomination, but there is a cure for the complaint. Repentance," says Thomas. This one from Mark says, "A very good show, many angles covered. Ed inspired as a God-honouring Christian seeking to live out a radical discipleship. And the American lady, I assume you mean there, Rosaria Butterfield, beautifully expressed the call of the true gospel. Quotes from the other guests revealed the essential root of the problem. I wasn't getting the happiness I needed. I asked God into the path I'd chosen. And the implication that denying oneself homosexual engagement equated with denying who you are. In our comfortable Western church, we've spent decades reshaping the gospel as man-centred rather than Christ-centred, denying self, losing one's life. Not my will, but God's will be done. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. These have gradually and subtly morphed into God wants me to be happy. Because of this shift in theology, we end up pastorally indulging a self that actually needs to die to Christ. Yes, this may bring a more immediate relief, but its long-term result is destructive to our real image of God's self. Happiness can't be found as a goal in itself. This idol defines the cultural context Christianity is infected by. The truth that sets us free is that happiness is a byproduct of loving and serving and obeying God. To me, Ed seems to get this and is living it. He should be honoured. But also, amid the struggle to be true to Jesus, he's experiencing the reward in his own being. He expresses grace, but not at the expense of truth. There certainly needs to be an ever greater openness and reality in churches, without any fear. We must all work to ensure that happens. But along with Ed, we need to hold the line of God's truth, calling disciples to die, but in all the context of loving grace. Truth kills without grace. Grace kills without truth." Thank you very much for saying that, and you very kind comments at the end, Mark, where you say it's a huge subject, but you did brilliantly to put it all together. Ian says, "This was a really mixed bag, producing all sorts of emotions. Ed Shaw was excellent, as was the clip from Rosaria Butterfield. Both of them built on a respect for God's world, a reality in living it out and demonstrating that the true freedom that the gospel brings. They were a joy and a challenge to listen to. Then there was the slipperiness of Steve Chalk with his pretense of taking God's word seriously when he in fact makes himself the judge of the word, producing the errors that he's well known for. Finally, there was sadness at Jane Ozan's situation and the solution she has adopted." And you're going to say next week will be quite different. Yes, well, it certainly was on the ontological argument. OK, Graham, coming at this from a different perspective to the ones we've just read, he says, "Regarding this week's debate, I thoroughly enjoyed it as always. My only comment is that it seems inevitable to me that in 20 years, maybe less, gay couples will be able to get married in the majority of Protestant churches. Gay people in married physical relationships with their partners will be part of the clergy. I think there's a historical inevitability about this. If it didn't happen, the church would find itself so far out of the mainstream of public opinion that it would have difficulty surviving. I think the acceptance of women clergy is a direct parallel to this. Can it be that far off to see a woman Archbishop of Canterbury? Most Christians will see this as a response to God's continuing revelation to his flock. I would see it as religion catching up with the secular development of human rights." And you had some other comments on other shows too, Graham, but perhaps we'll leave those for another time. But lots of response to that programme. So thanks for all those who have been in touch who wanted to talk about it. Thanks also to others who have been in touch just to say they've enjoyed listening to the programme. I even had an email from a long-lost acquaintance called Conrad, living elsewhere in Europe, but who we haven't literally spoken for years and years and years, but he discovered the programme and got in touch. So it was lovely to have that email and reignite an old acquaintance. But here's Casey, I think that's how it's pronounced, who wants to talk about the one from a couple of weeks ago. Is genocide a skeleton in God's closet? Now, you say the obvious differences between Yahweh and Jesus is one of the biggest difficulties I have as a theist. And because of this difficulty, as well as others, I have a hard time calling myself a Christian. And I tend to use a more agnostic theism approach to my beliefs. Basically, I believe Jesus was a revolutionary who challenged the authorities of his time. I found myself agreeing with almost everything your guest Jeff Cook had to say in regards to the differences between Yahweh and Jesus' personalities and what seemed to be Jesus revising Old Testament laws. What I didn't get from Jeff is how he reconciles those differences. And I think the reason you didn't get that is because Jeff fully admitted he hasn't really reconciled that in his own mind. But anyway, you say he believes Jesus is worth worshipping and Yahweh is not, yet he also believes in the Trinity. I don't think he quite said Yahweh is not worth worshipping. I think he maybe went more for a perspective that he doesn't see that those texts are necessarily divinely inspired or something like that. But anyway, you say, in conclusion, to me, the Old Testament is a product of its time and Yahweh nothing more than a Bronze Age God. You just feel that it can't be reconciled with the person of Jesus. I beg to disagree. I think that Jesus, you know, read the same Old Testament that we read, but that Jesus, yes, he shed a completely different, if you like, light upon them, perhaps, than they had been seen in before. And as for, you know, Jesus, a revolutionary who challenged the authorities of his time, yes, of course, he was revolutionary and he challenged the authorities of his time. But I don't think that's all he did. And if we were to read the Gospels for what they are, they obviously make far larger claims than that about Jesus in terms of his divinity and his part in ushering in the kingdom of God. But in any case, Casey, good to have your input. Thank you very much. We're just about out of time, I'm afraid. So we're going to have to leave it there. But thanks for all the many emails and comments in regard to last week's show. And again, if you want to read the article or catch up in any way with the what's available via premierchristianity.com, that's the place to go. Time to tell you what's coming up. Same time next week. I hope you can come back then. You're unbelievable. Well, Peter S. Williams joins me again alongside two friends of his, Callum Miller and Ruth Preston. They're both from the UK Apologetics Facebook page and blog. And as a threesome, they're going to be taking questions from callers. I put out earlier this week a call for anyone who's an unbelievable listener via Facebook, who's an atheist or agnostic, to get in touch and we'll set up a few calls with your objections and questions for the panel. We did just that. And you're going to be hearing the results next week on Saturday. So hope you can come back for that as we take calls from around the world from atheists and our panel attempt to answer them. 2:30 p.m. here on Premier Christian Radio or online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.